Orleans. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Danny Barker was a banjo and rhythm guitar player whose discography reads like no other in jazz. He played with Louis Armstrong and Dr. John, with Billie Holiday and the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, with Cab Calloway and Charlie Parker. In his spare time, he saved the New Orleans brass band tradition. But Barker never lost sight of what jazz is all about. Lovers on a dance floor.
He wants to squeeze her, et cetera, things that a man would do, that a woman wants a man to do, huh? And he's close to her, and the bodies and hearts beat together, and the vibration of the limbs and the muscles and coordination. Got that?
Got it. Danny Barker, after the break. In 1930, a young banjo player named Danny Barker walked into the Rhythm Club in Manhattan looking for work. His uncle had brought him there. The Rhythm Club was where all the black musicians hung out, wishing and waiting on gigs while making the most of the hours in between. They were always competing, shooting pool or trading clever insults known as the dozens, or dazzling each other in jam sessions within earshot of potential employers. Band leaders were also at the Rhythm Club. Fletcher Henderson, Joe King Oliver, Jelly Roll Morton, Chick Webb. On that day, the musicians were playing a song that Webb had made famous, Liza, All the Clouds Will Roll Away. Barker had come straight out of New Orleans. Years later, in an interview for the Smithsonian's Jazz Oral History Program, he remembered that his uncle, drummer Paul Barbaran, made the introductions, beginning with drummer Alfonso Steele.
Paul said, look out for my nephew, Steele. Steele said, all right, I'll look out for him. Is he all right? Is he wise or is he a fool? Paul said, he's not a fool. He's partner wise, southern wise.
Danny Barker was wise, and maybe even a little foolish. To his mind, jazz was an exciting and original African-American music that grabbed the world by the ears. He understood it as an expression of human experience unlike any other, made in a nation unlike any other. But for most African-American jazz musicians, the rewards were few. The money wasn't much to speak of, nor the accommodations during Jim Crow. But Barker withstood the aggravation to play music, to tell the story of jazz from its earliest beginnings, and to encourage others to keep the music going. Without his efforts, much of jazz history and the New Orleans music tradition would be lost. New Orleans writer Jason Berry was a friend of Barker's and featured him in a landmark book he co-authored called Up from the Cradle of Jazz.
I thought of him, frankly, as a self-styled witness, as someone who was present at a great many points along the curve of time in jazz history. He was not just a storyteller, he was a carrier of the culture.
When Barker was growing up, there was no such thing as traditional jazz. He was hearing contemporary music. New Orleans musicians were playing a variety of styles then, including European quadrilles and waltzes, the blues, and a brass band repertoire that included sacred songs and danceable head arrangements. Barker also was hearing a cross-section of dialects. Born in the French Quarter in 1909, he lived in what Tulane University geographer Richard Campanella calls one of the nation's first truly multi-ethnic neighborhoods.
If you were in the streets of the French Quarter 100 years ago this year, you would still hear old French Creole on the streets. But for every one voice speaking French, you would also hear one speaking Sicilian, and you would probably hear four or five speaking English.
The French Quarter's Creole population was white and black. Barker's mother, Rose, was a Barbaran, which meant she belonged to a large, French-speaking, black Creole clan of musicians, many of them top-notch. Danny's father, Moses Barker, was nicknamed Sweetie. His family was African-American, neither Creole nor French-speaking. For years, Danny lived with his paternal grandparents in the French Quarter on Charter Street. Again, Richard Campanella.
If you go to his birthplace, which is on the, 1,000 block of Charters, walk a few feet over to the left, in other words, heading upriver on the same block, and there's an old stable there. Now it's apartments or something. And look in the sidewalk, you know, the tiles spell an Italian name who apparently ran the stables or owned that building. So right on his own block, you know, he born in 1909, right? He would have been surrounded by Sicilian families.
That crowd of cultures, African-American, Creole, European, is believed to have created the musical cross-pollination that became jazz. In 1917, the original Dixieland Jazz Band made the first jazz record, which featured Nick LaRocca, a Sicilian, on cornet. Was only 8 years old when Livery Stable Blues became a national sensation. But by then, he'd already been exposed to musicians whose influence would surpass that of the original Dixieland Jazz Band. The latest compilation of Danny Barker's words and music by GHB Records includes this observation.
And I mean, like, you couldn't compare Nick LaRocca in the capacity as a trumpet player with King Oliver or Louis Armstrong or Freddie Keppard. Or Tommy Ladin there. I mean, he's a great trumpet player, but there's something in the melodic structure of his playing that don't have the feeling that these people have.
Then, as always, the city had a deep roster of African-American talent playing jazz funerals and dances, lawn parties and fish fries, dance halls, cabarets, brothels, and all manner of street celebrations. Barker's grandfather was Isidore Barbaran, and he played alto horn. Again, Danny Barker.
He played in the greatest of brass bands, the Onward Brass Band, the mighty Onward. And that band was Freddie Keppard, Manuel Perez, Papa Celestine, and King Oliver played in that band. Bung Johnson played in that band. So all them greats was in that band.
Competition was ferocious, spilling from New Orleans to wherever New Orleanians performed. The Gulf Coast, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. For a while, Freddie Keppard was king. Turned down the first jazz recording contract, but Joe Oliver is said to have outblown Keppard. And when Oliver's star rose, he took a flood of people with him. Everybody knows about Oliver as the mentor of Louis Armstrong, but Barker said Oliver's Creole jazz band boosted the Barbarans as well.
My uncle, Paul Barbaran, was King Oliver. So my grandmother and my grandfather and me and Willie, my uncle, we go to Chicago. I'm what, 10, Willie's 12. And me and Willie would get up 6 o'clock in the morning and walk around the south side. See, and me and my uncle used to go in and watch the people in the cabaret. People couldn't see us, but we'd be looking. You know, like this is 7 o'clock in the morning, man, and these people in there bawling. You see the men kissing the women, feeling on the women. And you see the band playing.
canoodling on a weekday morning while a jazz band played? No wonder young Danny chose music as a full-time career. In New Orleans, young Danny eventually settled on banjo. Even as a child, he was a good rhythm man. Dr. Michael White teaches African American music at Xavier University. As a young clarinetist, White played with Barker and in 1992 interviewed him for the Smithsonian.
In early New Orleans, I mean, where music is a participatory sport, music is for people to react to dance to. You know, he came up in that tradition. He was a rhythm man, a rhythm guitar player. He played solid, steady rhythms, what he called fat chords, extended chords, but not dissonant, that made both the rhythm and the harmonic sequences very appealing to soloists as well.
While still wearing short pants, Barker started the Boozan Kings, a children's band featuring makeshift instruments. That's how he saw the last days of Storyville, an area of legalized prostitution in New Orleans that the federal government closed in 1917. Storyville faded slowly. Bruce Rayburn heads the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane University. He says the brothels closed first, but music remained a draw.
It's not the end of the line for the saloons and the bars and places that were putting on musical entertainment in Storyville. And what Danny was trying to penetrate where the musicians were and where the money was. If he could be outside the saloons with the Boozan Kings creating a racket, someone might throw some coins in his direction. That's what he was about.
Barker soon began playing professionally. In the 1920s, he toured with Little Brother Montgomery, who played blues piano and boogie-woogie to racially segregated audiences across Mississippi. Then, Barker toured the racially segregated Gulf Coast with a band led by trumpet player Lee Collins. By the time Barker reached the age of 20, he'd had quite an education. Again, Bruce Rayburn.
So he was being mentored by top banjo players, by top cornet players. He was affiliated with one of the most interesting bands, Jones and Collins' Astoria Hot 8. Lee Collins had also sort of taken Danny under his wing. So Danny had a variety of experiences before he leaves New Orleans and he goes to Harlem.
By 1930, Barker was married and needed to support a family, so he took a train heading north. Barker's uncle Paul Barbaran and New Orleans trumpet player Henry Red Allen met him at Penn Station.
It was a hell of a scene, 5 o'clock in the evening in New York. 50,000 people going in all directions, nobody bumping into one another. Coming this way, going that way, coming this way. And I'm trying to get through this crowd with a banjo and a paper box to the least. And I've seen all these people. I ain't used to bumping into people. Man, it looked like a stampede. You know, the Spanish people be running with them bulls in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Out in Spain, you see them, they're running and bulls is behind them. But finally, they got you and they grabbed me by the hand and drugged me through all them people, boy.
Barker would remain in New York City for the next 35 years. Coming up, Grand Theft Banjo, a crime story with a happy ending. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and we're hearing Buster Bailey and his seven chocolate dandies play Call of the Delta. This may be the first recording that jazz man Danny Barker ever made. Call of the Delta was produced in 1934, roughly 4 years after Barker had arrived in New York. But notice, Barker is not playing the banjo he brought from New Orleans. He's playing guitar.
They stole my banjo. I left my banjo overnight in the club and come back the next night, the banjo was gone.
The crime remains unsolved. In retrospect, the theft of Barker's banjo could not have been better timed. By the 1930s, the banjo was going the way of silent movies and horse-drawn buggies. Dr. Michael White says the rise of big bands required a more refined sound.
So they softened up the rhythm sections. The banjo, which can be very loud and overpowering, was replaced by the smoother, softer guitar. And the tuba, which was used sometimes, was finally and solidly replaced by the upright bass. So he would have had to go through this transition where he realized that, you know, banjo was out, guitar was in, and to make a living, he had to go in that direction.
That sounds great, as long as the banjo player can play guitar. And not just play. Barker had to perform well enough to compete with every other big band guitar strummer in New York.
So I'm scuffling with the guitar. Got to learn the guitar right away. You see, New York's not no place to go there to practice. When you get to New York, you're supposed to have your gun cocked and ready to shoot. You don't come there going in the woodshed.
Don Vappi is a banjo and guitar player who teaches music at Loyola University, New Orleans.
You got to learn a new instrument in, what, a week, 2 weeks or something? I'm sure he could do it. If you learn major chords, minor chords, you sort of can get by, you know. You can add the diminished ones, augmented ones, whatever. I'm sure it wasn't that difficult, but it would be pressure.
The best-known rhythm player in those years was Freddie Green from the Count Basie Orchestra. But Green and Barker had different sensibilities. Green relied on a lean sound, but Barker was known for mastering fat chords, bringing more texture to the beat. It's hard to describe, which is why Don Vappi will demonstrate.
Freddie Green with Basie played like two notes. He would play that kind of thing, which is fine. With that band, it worked great. It was a sort of a bridge between the harmonic and the rhythmic. And Danny, what he means by fat is you don't necessarily need a piano. Instead of, you play the whole thing. Big chords. Try to add the bass, and that makes for a big sound. Sometimes you need to fill up the band. You need to help support the bottom of the band, the foundation. That's what he meant by fat, foundation.
Here's Barker and his fat chords filling out the foundation of Henry Red Allen's 1935 song, Believe It, Beloved. Back then, rhythm guitar players rarely took a solo, but we're hearing Barker all right, in the pocket, which means he's strumming smack dab in the middle of the beat.
Oh, believe it, beloved, because it's true. You are that I want you to be. You are darling, a double devil go. Love someone who looks like me.
Barker is said to have appeared on more than 1,000 recordings. Many of those sessions took place during the big band era, with Red Allen, or Ethel Waters, or Lionel Hampton, or his wife, Lulu Barker, for whom he also wrote. Here's a sample of some of the earliest songs Barker helped bring into the world.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. Boy, how they could love. Or to be true to each other,
above, 'cause he was her man. But he done her wrong.
There's a kitchen up in heaven where to bake them biscuits brown. There's a kitchen up in heaven where the chicken's always round. There's a kitchen up in heaven with a stove that's always hot. There's a kitchen up in heaven that sure does cook a lot.
Never brag about your maid. All you will be without your maid. Sonny always did the lovely things he should. But he stopped the day I bragged that he was good.
The years 1939 to 1946 would be Barker's most lucrative. That's when he played with Cab Calloway's band. Calloway was then the highest paid black entertainer in the nation. He brought the world Minnie the Mooch, the Heidi Ho Man, Smokey Joe, Tarzan of Harlem, the Floogie Walk. Oh, just listen.
Heidi, Heidi, Heidi,
Heidi. Heidi, Heidi, Heidi.
All answer to his call. Whoa!
Remember when I kicked the bucket in my mansion up on Stivers Row? When they came and took me off in a $1 zillion coffin, 'cause I'm the ghost of Smokey Joe.
What's the matter with that cat there?
Must be full of reefer.
Full of reefer?
Yeah, man.
You mean that cat's high?
Sailing.
Sailing?
Sailing lightly.
Get away from here.
Man, is that the reefer, man?
That's the reefer, man.
I believe he's losing his mind.
I think he's lost his mind.
The Calloway Orchestra was primarily a touring band. They played nightclubs and movie theaters nationwide, or sometimes appeared in Hollywood movies. Barker's daughter Sylvia remembers rarely seeing him.
They were all over the country, and he was hardly ever home. So when he was home, it was exciting, and if it was a holiday, he was playing music somewhere else. He had to go to the nightclub or the stage in a theater during mealtimes. So we hardly ever had him at home during the holidays. He was always playing, and when he was home, he was practicing.
Chances are Barker was practicing on a stout, brown 1937 guitar with a gold tailpiece and mother-of-pearl inlays along the neck. It's the same guitar he later gave Steve Mazakowski, who teaches guitar, jazz theory, and composition at the University of New Orleans.
This is Danny Barker's guitar, and it's the one he used with Cab Calloway. So it's made by Gibson. It's called the Super 400. It's actually the largest bodied guitar that Gibson ever made, you know. So it has no pickup. It was meant to be played acoustically. And it was really meant to be played in a big band kind of scenario. It's a beautiful instrument. You know, it's like every time I pick it up, it's like playing history, you know. You know? Has a certain sound to it. It's this really, really beautiful sound. Very organic sound, you know, because it's like, it's probably the purest kind of Yeah, it's a guitar in its purest sense. Nothing touching the body, no pickups, no wires, nothing like that, you know? Thank you.
When Barker left the Calloway band in 1946, Calloway asked him to find a replacement who could sound exactly the way he did. Barker applied his energies to smaller ensembles. He recorded with the All-Star Stompers on the This Is Jazz radio broadcasts, with Louis Armstrong, and with Sidney Bechet. And he wrote and recorded more songs with his wife, Blue Lou. Some sessions scared him, like the recording date with Charlie Parker and Dexter Gordon. Sessions were as familiar to Barker as the corner of Basin and Canal Streets here in New Orleans.
Here comes the big chief, the big chief, the yellow Pocahontas, the pretty monogram Hunters, and they don't bow down on nobody's ground.
Nobody's ground.
Oh, how we love to hear you call us Indian Red, the wild Swatunas. White eagles, the pretty eight-barred hunters, the Wild West Shoshone hunters, and we don't bow down on nobody's ground.
Nobody's ground.
Oh, how we love to hear you call us Indian Red.
But jazz was shrinking. After World War II, the big bands faded away. Bebop attracted more intimate audiences, and the titans of the music were falling like autumn leaves. Barker's most high-profile job was for the 1957 CBS program Sound of Jazz. The television broadcast featured a rare collection of talent, including Billie Holiday and saxophonist Lester Young. It would be the last time they played together.
My man don't love me. He treats me oh so mean. Treats me awful mean. Now he's the lowest man that I've ever seen.
Billy was dying then, the skin and bones, and Lester Young had been drinking so much brandy. Tell his eyes, you know, you can see that their eyes look like two eggs in a bowl of milk or something. The eyes had lost their pupil. He was so drunk. But he got right there, and his tune was bouncing, and, you know, real grooving. And Lester just took his time, and just from experience, played a real lazy, slow solo, which is a classic.
While jazz lovers remember the all-star lineup, not many can remember the thin man with the mustache on guitar. That's Danny Barker. Again, Dr. Michael White.
Billie Holiday and Lester Young, Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Jerry Mulligan, Vic Dickinson, Henry Red Allen, Pee Wee Russell, the Count Basie band, basically. And so many other great people. So, I mean, those are big, big names. And, you know, it's almost like being on a championship football team and you're the defensive end, but all of the accolades go to the quarterback and the running back and the guys who score touchdowns. So I think he did feel kind of left behind in a sense. not having a, let's say, more visibility and more financial success and more of a big career in New York, I guess that was kind of rough for him.
Within a year, Holiday and Young were dead, and many of the other performers were entering the last phase of their professional lives. Ben Webster eventually moved to Europe. Coleman Hawkins lost interest in the music he'd been making. And in 1965, Danny and Lulu Barker gave up New York and drove home to stay. Coming up, Danny Barker back on the streets of New Orleans, and the children shall lead. Stay tuned. That's Danny's Banjo Blues. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. We're talking about rhythm guitar and banjo player Danny Barker this hour. Born in the French Quarter in 1909, Barker spent more than 30 years playing with top acts in New York City. But changing music tastes drove him and his wife, singer Lulu Barker, back to New Orleans. It was 1965, and they were finally among people who shared their same musical sensibilities. In New York, jazz was becoming concert hall music. In New Orleans, jazz had long been dance music, but not so fast.
New Orleans, authentic New Orleans jazz is pool people in a nightclub and a cabaret. A man with some money in his pocket and a beautiful woman, and he wants to get up on the floor. He wants to dance with her. And he don't want to be on the dance floor getting out of breath when he's dancing to her. He wants to talk to her while he's dancing. He wants to squeeze her, et cetera, things that a man would do, that a woman wants a man to do. Huh? And he's close to her, and the bodies and the hearts beat together, and the vibration of the limbs and the muscles and coordination. Got that?
Here's Danny Barker at the pace where bodies and hearts can beat together.
Maybe I'm right and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm weak and maybe I'm strong. But nevertheless, I'm in love with you. Maybe I will win and maybe I'll lose. Most times I'll lose. Maybe I'm in for crying a whole lot of blues. But nevertheless, I'm in love with you. Somehow I knew at a glance the terrible drastic chances I was taking, honey child. Right from the start, the kind of a heart that was breaking. Maybe I'll live a life of regret. Maybe I'll give up much more than I get. Oh, but nevertheless, I'm in love with you. Baby, 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 oh yeah.
Nevertheless, I'm in love with you by Danny Barker. The Barkers' return to New Orleans in 1965 was not exactly triumphant. They were strapped for money in New York, and Danny was suffering with diabetes. But his timing, as usual, was excellent. By the mid-1960s, the nation was in the midst of a second jazz revival. The New Orleans Jazz Museum had opened in the French Quarter, as had Preservation Hall and other traditional jazz clubs. Barker helped curate the museum, dusted off his banjo, and cobbled together enough gigs to make a life. He also recorded. But every music lover in New Orleans knows that Barker did more than that. Bruce Rayburn curates the Hogan Jazz Archive at Tulane.
The Fairview Baptist Church experiment was crucial to the survival of brass bands and jazz heritage in New Orleans. Danny Barker single-handedly, through an intervention, saved that tradition in the 1970s. I don't think that's putting it too strongly.
The Fairview Baptist Church is in the 7th Ward, not far from the itsy bitsy house that the Barkers owned on Sear Street. In 1970, Reverend Andrew Darby Sr., then pastor of the church, needed a band. And not only that, he wanted boys in and around the church to have some good, clean fun. Most young people at the time were more interested in soul and R&B than in New Orleans brass band music. But there were exceptions. Trumpeter Leroy Jones lived near the Fairview. He was only 12 years old when Barker came to see him.
Danny Barker used to hear me practice in the garage. And Danny often drove by in his car. And one day he pulled up in front of the house and he came up and introduced himself. "My name's Danny Barker. I hear you practicing, you sound really, really good." And he told me, he said, "My pastor has asked me to gather up some young people that might be interested in being a part of a youth band that he's forming at the church. And would you like to be a part of that?" So I called my mom and she said it was okay, so it was okay.
Barker appointed Jones to be the leader of the Fairview Baptist Church Christian band. And who could resist a man like him? Back then, Barker was tall, tan, and terrific. He wore a hat and a toupee.
It wasn't like one of the best toupees I think someone would want to put on their heads. But I mean, hey, it worked for him. And his attire was very colorful. Often Dan would wear these plaid coats, you know, with his, and, you know, he wasn't afraid to wear white trousers, and he had the coolest walk, you know. I mean, Danny had a walk that was one of those real swaggers, you know. Yeah, he was the coolest old dude that I can recall. No, even cooler than my dad, you know.
Trombonist Lucian Barbaran is a band leader and longtime member of the Harry Connick Jr. Orchestra. For him, the Fairview was a family affair. Danny Barker was an uncle, and Lucian's father and brother were also part of the band. He remembers those mornings in the 1970s when the Fairview band woke up an entire neighborhood.
Every Easter Sunday, we was always looking forward to that particular day. We would parade from the Fairview Baptist Christian Church around San Bernard Housing Project. And we would march. I guess this was to wake up everybody and get them to come down to the church service in the project.
Drummer Herlin Riley is also a band leader and a veteran of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra. But back then, he played trumpet. His grandfather brought him to Leroy Jones's house.
Another guy who was also there, who was very, very Mr. Barker's assistant, and nobody ever gives him credit, is Mr. Charles Barberan. And that's Lucian Barberan's and Charles Jr.'s father. And I was amazed and I was fascinated that there were people of my same age who were playing jazz, who were interested in Louis Armstrong and interested in Sidney Bechet and interested in the Olympia Brass Band, you know, the rich legacy of the music. People who were like 12, 13, some guys were 10. You know, the Fairview Marching Band, the age range was from like 8 to 18.
Mm.
And it didn't matter your skill level or whatever. You know, Mr. Barker, he said, "Just bring your horn, come on by, we'll teach you some songs." So eventually we would go out and march a parade or something and come back and make $2 a piece, you know.
Well, after six hours work.
Yeah,
right?
But it wasn't even about the money. It was about, you know, learning the music and being part of the history and the legacy of New Orleans music.
You know, it's true. It's almost as if Barker reminded young people of what their birthright was.
Exactly. That's exactly right. He reminded us what our birthright was as New Orleanians.
But money did become a problem. The Fairview ballooned into two bands, and the boys attracted so many gigs that the Musicians Union complained about unfair competition. The Fairview reportedly was making $1,000 a parade. That's $100 per player. And the union suspected that Barker might be working the young people for his own financial gain. Again, Leroy Jones.
Danny never took a cut. During that period, we were handling those things ourselves. Mr. Barber and Lucian and Charles' father dealt with that and was a good steward about it. So we were all paid. We were learning the ropes of what it means to be a working professional musician.
Barker stepped back, but he delighted in the success of the Fairview members. It's impossible to count every song that's been touched by the Fairview, but without that young band, these songs by the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, by Shannon Powell, by the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, and by Harry Connick Jr. would never have sounded the same. Playing and recording. In 1986, his years of research on the history of jazz and his own experiences as a jazz professional paid off. Macmillan Press, then Oxford University Press, published Barker's memoir, A Life in Jazz. Not long after, the National Endowment for the Arts named him a jazz master. Well into old age, after a lifetime of struggle, Barker was in the pink. But curiously, he stopped playing banjo. Trumpeter and former Fairview member Greg Stafford was the first to notice. He was in Barker's band, which played the Palm Court Cafe on Decatur Street.
I said, what about the banjo, Mr. Barker? Would you keep asking me all these GD questions. I said, well, I guess I'll tell you what's going on. I don't play that banjo because my side has hurt me. And I strum that banjo, I don't know, my side is hurting all the time. So the guitar is a little bit lighter, and I don't have to work so much. So I said, Mr. Barker, if your side is hurting you, you need to check that out. He said, well, maybe I'll get around to it. And I went to Mexico with Preservation Hall. So my mother called me and said to me that Mr. Barker was trying to find me because he had got the report from the doctor. So I immediately called him, and he said, yes, I figure you need to know. I got the big C. I said, what? I said, yes, I have I have cancer of the pancreas. I said, oh, Mr. Buck, I'm sorry to hear that. He said, oh, don't worry about it. He says, you know, the doctor told me, you know, some people can be treated for it. Some people live on that might extend 5 more years to their life. Well, I didn't say to him that I knew that wasn't so. I don't know if he knew that I knew it wasn't so. He said, well, don't worry, young man. You have a nice time down there in Mexico. Don't spend all your money. I said, okay. I said, well, I'm going to be praying for you. So that was the end of that conversation.
When Stafford returned to New Orleans, he hurried to Barker's house.
And there he was lying on the sofa. And so he was very conscientious, but he was very weak. He says, man, I'm so glad to see you. He says, you need to get down there to the Palm Coast. I want you to take over the band. I said, okay, Mr. Barker. So we sat and we talked. I told him about my experiences in Mexico. So he says, well, I'm here, but this cancer is a hell of a thing. So Miss Lou and Sylvia were in the kitchen. And when I walked into the house, when they greeted me, Miss Lou was saying to me that she was making funeral arrangements and she needed to talk to me. I said, Miss Lou, I can't talk about that right now. I said, really? Well, you know, I was like almost... Excuse me.
Barker died at home on March 13th, 1994. He was 85 years old. The Fairview alumni and other musicians in the city gave him one of the most spectacular jazz funerals ever.
And he said to me one time, he said, man, this is before he passed, you know. Man, I didn't know that I was going to create all this. All I was trying to do was just get some kids off the street and give them something to do. I didn't know it was going to materialize in something big like this, you know. I said, Mr. Buckle, well, if you didn't do it, nobody else would have done it. So I said, thank God for Leroy Jones, Charlie Barber, and Lucian Barber, and me, Dr. Michael White. I said, all your students are the ones who playing jazz in New Orleans today.
At the end of his 1992 Smithsonian interview, Barker sums up his extraordinary career by naming nearly every band he'd ever played with. Notice, two of the words he uses most frequently are played and pleasure.
What I'd like to say, is that it's been a pleasure in the profession to be a musician, to have played with some of the early greats in the 20s, from 1925 to 30, I played with Buddy Petit, sat in with Kid Rene, played with David Jones and Lee Collins. I played with some very old musicians. It was a pleasure. And I joined to New York and I played with Benny Carter, Step by Step, Jim James P. Johnson's band, I played with Dave Nelson's band. I played with, who else? Lucky Milner's band, which was an exciting band. Cab Calloway's band. And I had the pleasure of doing that. I've recorded with a lot of musicians who appreciated me and quite a few. The leaders appreciated me and some of the bands,
The tape runs out on Barker at his best, in mid-sentence. There's no telling what he would have said next. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Rick G. Nelson, Paul McDonald, Steve Panacek, Garrett Pittman, and Jason Rhine. Music Inside Out is produced in partnership with WWNO. Special thanks this week go to Detroit Brooks, Lars Ettergren, Stephanie McCrumman, Trevor Richards, Jeanette Hardy, the Preservation Hall Foundation, Alan Shipton, and the Historic New Orleans Collection. To learn more about Danny and Blue Lou Barker, and for a complete playlist of songs in this hour, go to our website at musicinsideout.org. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Major support for Music Inside Out comes from the Historic New Orleans Collection. Music Inside Out also receives support from the Ruth U. Fertel Foundation, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, the Rosa Mary Foundation, the Pinkelope Foundation, which my wife, Diana Pinkley, and I established, Baba Jim Istanbul Studios and Mastering, Adam Newman Designs, and WWNO. Donations to Music Inside Out are tax-deductible, thanks to our partnership with the National Performance Network. For more information about how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.
Heart of my heart, how I love that melody. Heart of my heart, it brings back my